the level of sympathy and empathy is weak. So I did a lot of work with a domestic abuse charity before as well, and I found with that I could elicit sympathy even when we were doing work around donations and lots of stuff, and corporates would engage with it. As soon as I moved in, well, even in the past, in the space of sexual violence, it's like, there's so much in that, you know, like almost as if people say, well, we'll support that, but women lie. Women lie, women lie, women lie. And every woman who's coming, this is this type of inbuilt. And I think it comes from deep ingrained fear from men that they will be accused of rape. So that power is so powerful that any time there's any, they see it, then they're more likely, and women do this as well, they're more likely to acquit than actually think about justice, because they become so moved almost by the defendant's story, because the focus is so much on the defendant, you know, because that's what they have to do. They just have to overturn the evidence. And you can't have, like, you know, they don't use this much now, but like character witnesses, you know, this person's upstanding member of community, because it just got nothing to do with rape. You could have somebody, you know, anybody could be potentially a rapist. You can have children and be, you seem like a family man, and you could still be a rapist. And I think one of the ways that's come to more of the, like, society consciousness is actually due to pornography, child pornography. And that awareness that actually people are, I can't believe that person would look at child pornography. I just can't. And then I think some level, some people, oh, right, it's that pervasive. But really interesting to think about how deeply some of this is instilled. And I mean, you know, talking about the Diddy trial, and there's different perspectives and things on that one. But when it's been about Cassie and the domestic abuse, you see, it's fine, cut, it's fine, even though she was accused of lying before that. But if you, as soon as you move into the sexual space, it's always, always suspicion. Always. Like, you know, I just hear it all the time. It's literally all the time. God.
Yeah.
You know, you know, then the other side as well, into some of the barristers. I work with some really amazing barristers, by the way, who are progressive and who see it. And, you know, they say things like, one of them says, you know, I will, you know, prosecute something to the nth degree, but I will tell you about another situation where I feel perhaps consent wasn't understood. So sometimes there can be a kind of fairness in the way that they're starting to look at it. But I do think there's still just a lot of suspicion numbers. You know, in the UK, I mean, sorry, in England, barristers are doing back-to-back cases because it's been such a bit. So that's a real risk factor in itself, because you start to sort of... And somebody said to me, I don't mean to sound insensitive, but for me it's just another case, another case, another case, another case. So they walk away from that as a win or in their mind. And then I'm sort of seeing the sea of people who can't move on from it. So you know, it's crazy. And you know, it'd be interesting, I'd love to find out a bit more from you as well about Canada and kind of general attitudes towards sort of sexual violence. And if that's, do you feel there's like a, you know, it's a big sweeping conversation, but do you feel if there's like sympathy there or suspicion?
I'm not too sure. I do find it interesting because, to be honest, I've been over here since August and I haven't seen or heard much until this Canadian hockey trial. And what I think this one... One, I think personally from what I've read about it, I do think it was kind of a strategy from the defense lawyers because of the fact it happened twice. And I'm pretty sure it was the same lawyers. So to me, it kind of feels like that seems too much of a coincidence that two juries have been dismissed. It seems to me more of a strategy to make it a judge-only trial for whatever reason. But I think as well, it's a very complex case. Because one, alcohol was involved on both parties. So there was a lot being said of, oh, I'm not quite sure I remember on this from both sides. But also, she did have consensual sex in this at the time as well. So she had consensual sex with one of them, and then it was he invited a load of his friends over and she wasn't consenting after that. And so it was I think there's like a lot of misunderstanding of, oh, but she consented the first time, and there's that myth of like consent isn't just a one-time thing, it's an ongoing thing. So that, I think, adds another complicated factor to it. Also, it's apparently there was a video that was recorded of her giving consent as well. She doesn't remember the video, and I'm not sure if it played in court. But obviously there's then the thing of like, so when was that consent given in terms of other things and things like that? Is also it's interesting because the five guys accused said that they felt uncomfortable, and there was up to 11 men in the room with just her, and they said, oh, but we were feeling uncomfortable because she wanted to have sex with these two people and they didn't want to, but then they wanted other sexual favors. So there's kind of these gaps where you're like, but if you were uncomfortable, why didn't you leave? Why did you stay? And then they were said that they were all egging each other on to have sex with her. So if you were really uncomfortable and awkward, why would you have chosen to act like that, stay, and not leave the situation? And also from her side, she's saying they didn't let her leave. So then if you're uncomfortable, why are you refusing to let her leave either? So it's a very, I haven't heard much of like biased opinions from people I've spoken to that have read about the case. A lot of them, I think, believe her because she's very openly said, yes, I did have consensual sex with them at that time. She's not trying to hide the fact that she did consent once. It was the fact that she said afterwards, I felt uncomfortable with the situation. I felt like something was wrong because they didn't let me leave and things like that. And because she consented to have sex, I think, with some of them, but not all of them. She didn't expect 11 men to show up and then not let her leave the room.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting case in that aspect, because I've not heard of a case like that in like mainstream media in England and things like that. Usually it's like there's just one complainant and one defendant, not like five and one.
Yeah, multi-perpetrator. And actually it has been going on for a long time, just not raised up. So when I was when I graduated university initially, I worked in television before I moved into the charity sector, and there was a case, there was a TV program called Dispatches on Channel 4, and I was helping the producer on some of the parts of it, and it was all about multi-perpetrator rape in England, and a lot of it being committed by young men, so under 21s, and you had huge cases, actually. You got London, Manchester, Liverpool, and it doesn't get enough traction. But a lot that I learned from that even then was and I remember working with talking to some young men on this who had been, as I said, moved out of mainstream school, and it was like this we had to talk quite a lot about this attitude of this thing called the train. So they say, well, if one girl, so say a girl, I don't know, let's say myself, I went to this boy that I knew from school, and me and him were seeing each other. So by seeing, I don't mean like full-on relationship, but maybe kissing, snogging, whatever. And then I decided to consent to have a sex with him. Then he said, a few boys said this to me, they call their boys, as I said it, and then they'd all come and they'd expect a train. Right. So the train is one after the other, which is you give them a blowjob or sex. And so these were becoming horrendous attacks in the, you know, because there had been, you know, some cases of people consenting, but under what circumstances as well. And also one of the things about kind of consent and duress is, you know, there's something about being in a space of fear and, you know, so many people in a room. How do you get yourself out of a situation, right? Do you comply to get through it? Because you know, in that situation, you could go through being beat up. You could be, you just comply. And so I really have come across a horrendous number of cases like that. And often they will not win. They don't win the cases at court. And they'll say, well, because she was drunk or she can't remember, etc. But the thing is, when it comes down to like consent and capacity, if you are a male and you say, well, I was drunk, I don't remember, actually, that can't be a defence. Because the onus is then on you. Well, if you were that drunk, how could you get consent? So it's really interesting, isn't it? And actually young men I've worked with have found that quite shocking. So sometimes in different spaces, almost like they're sleepwalking into criminality sometimes. I've obviously seen that. But this multi-perpetrator space is shocking. And the worst case I think I've ever come across was a case in London where a young girl who she'd just turned 13, and she was on her estate saving up on one boy that she knew. She'd gone back there, and then five other boys turned up. She didn't want any of it. They then invite more. But then there's a video of them. They dragged her across from one part of the estate to the other part of the estate, right? People saw her, tears, bragged about all these boys taken, and not one person stopped. Then you see the video, the CCTV footage of them taking her up in the lift. They then get there, and it continues. And this girl went through, I think it was about 4.5 hours of people being invited. Mm. So then what happens is an elder, so someone older community, came in and what the hell are you boys doing? And she called him her rescuer, and he took her away. Now, some of those boys were, I mean, the youngest, I'm sure, was 11.
Oh, my goodness.
And my son's nearly 12. And it speaks a lot about society, and speaks a lot about the group mentality, how people change in specific groups, right, and how they normalised that. But that case was one of the most horrendous cases. She did get a conviction in that case for some of the boys. There's another case in the 90s, famous case, where a tourist from Australia, have you heard of this one? She came over, and she was in Camden in England, and you've got the Regent Canal. And she was there, and she'd finished. It was only about 6 o'clock, and she'd finished at a day party, and she was there. And this group of boys started harassing her. So come to this party with us, or she was trying to be polite. But she was like, no, it's okay, thanks, you know, walking on. And then they grabbed her, and they took her, and they raped her, all of these boys. And then they threw her in the canal afterwards.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
Famous Australian case. But when it went to court, the horrifying thing about all of this, that case, why did they go to court?
Mm.
Why did they not plead guilty before they even went to court?
Mm-hmm.
They had the option. That speaks a lot to a system. I will not plead guilty because I think my chances of being acquitted are so high.
Yeah.
So if you're thinking about, and rape often can be multiple attacks. Depends what type you are, there's different types. So I'll just go not guilty.
Mm-hmm.
It happens so much. And because that's why the cycle of the system is so damaging, because it just, I don't really need to be that worried about being caught.
Yeah.
So so they are really horrific. You know, obviously, those cases are horrific, but I suppose for me, one of the struggles sometimes is people like, for example, Bonnie Blue
mm-hmm.
in England, who's obviously a content creator, and she, consensually, you know, does these trains and these lineups with these boys. I'm not judging her, whatever. I'm not in that space to judge people, right? But the problem sometimes is this ethos that girls want that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. And even she should be able to withdraw her consent.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's just a strange space that we live in, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think as well, one thing that I came across when I was looking at this Canadian hockey trial, because I discussed it on a show, my show that I did with a friend, because we were discussing the topic of jury versus judge-only trials in rape and sexual assault cases. And one thing that I came across that I haven't seen a lot of people speak about is the fact that both parties were drinking, which means that both parties couldn't have given informed consent. They both stated they were drunk, to the level of both parties not remembering certain details of what they're saying, in which I was like, so no one's picking up on the fact that both parties actually couldn't give consent anyway. And this idea that I've spoken quite a bit on the radio of educating people on what consent actually means and the definition behind it and how multi-layered it is. In that, I think when I was researching some of Dom's research, and the fact that one of the common rape myths being that the people can say no at any time, like yes isn't just a yes forever, things like that, and as well with it being looking at that you can't be raped if it was by your wife or your girlfriend or your boyfriend or your husband. It only can be sort of a stranger that can rape you. And looking at how much higher the conviction is on stranger rape cases to when the defendant and complainant were known to each other was so starking. I think it was like something like 36% to like 76%. In that, I was just mind blown when I was reading all of that. Because that's just, it's just crazy to me that people genuinely believe that rape can only happen in when you don't know each other. When more often than not, it's going to be someone that's close to you, that's in your space a lot more, that's in your personal spaces, at the home. That's going to happen a lot more, I feel.
Yeah. And things like, you know, it could be a cousin's friend or... family person that you've known. It could be, you know, it's a multitude of people. It could be, in a marriage, could be in a relationship. I mean, it's just so many different spaces of it. You know, because it's, and actually, we think about it, like going back in society, it's strange that we've come to that narrative of it can only be this and that, because it's an act. If you think about what the actual act of it is, it's taking something.
Mm-hmm.
And alluding, you know, a sense of power and control from that.
Yeah.
So, you know, so anybody could do that. It still, it doesn't matter who the victim is. It's still, so it's what I mean, it's scoping. So, in fact, in our educational course, we have a module on offending behaviour and what offenders mean, because there's been such a lot of focus actually on victims. And, you know, because complainants in the court, because you're trying to break down their credibility. In actual fact, if it was, prosecutors as well were skilled up a lot more in understanding offending behaviour, that could make it stronger.
Mm.
Because they might not even know when they're being manipulated. You know, like, for example, I've had barristers say things like, he seems such a nice guy and, you know, brilliant, works really hard, he's there for his wife. Somebody even had their pregnant wife in court, that sort of stuff, you know. So it's all this, it's sort of illusion sometimes. Even just, we're all like that, because you don't want to believe the worst. You don't want to believe that this crime exists in society. You want to believe that you're protected. You want to believe that there's control, that you're safe in society, when the reality actually is, we're not, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it's horrendous, but the truth is, that it's still there. So it's easier, as I say, psychologically, to think, well, that individual couldn't have done that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? So you really do see that's just out of the scope, and it's hard. And then occasionally I see people like, it's a, okay, crazy, crazy narrative person this is, but like talking about podcasts, Piers Morgan, for example, right, in England, and I have watched his journey over years and years, and actually I've noticed him become more central. So he used to be very... like women are lying, etc., etc., and now he started to say things like, well, actually, could there be two sides to a person? Could there be a perpetrator actually within that person? There could be. Yes, I've seen this person's like nice side, but what could be the other side? So I think it's getting that awareness across as well, that juries need to understand.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always what you see, but the suspicion is on the woman to have two sides.
Yeah.
Not the man, the accused, to have two sides. So it does come a lot down to that, of actually being able to accept that people will perpetrate.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, because it's always that you don't want to believe that someone has the capability of doing that, and to the level that you're seeing it in, say, like statistics and data, if you look at the amount of cases and the amount, I was looking at England and Wales and looking at how the amount of cases that were reported to the police and then the amount that went to Crown prosecution and then the amount from there that went to actually being charged. And you're thinking, one, it was a starking difference, because I believe the statistics were from about 2021, 2022. And it was saying about 60,000 odd were reported to the police. And that's just the ones that are actually being reported. And then when you looked at the end, it was about 3,000 that actually got charged. And I was just looking at that and thinking, oh my goodness. And then I didn't end up finding exactly how many then actually got convicted after that, but to know it would be such a minute number. And I remember talking to someone about the Diddy trial, And I said, I find it interesting that he has so many family members sitting in the court every single day. And she was actually saying to me, well, I think that's a strategy from his defense team. Because if the jury are constantly seeing his mother, his children, always there, it's painting this picture that he is a family man, that he is respectable and things like that. And to have them facing the jury the entire time, I didn't even think about that because I was thinking if I knew someone like that, how I could just sit and listen to the horrendous stuff that's going on. That he's being accused of, and I know like he's pled not guilty to all of it. But to be sitting there and having to listen to it all and knowing it's someone that you care about, because you wouldn't want to believe that they would be capable of doing that.
Well, no. Mm-hmm. And denial is a very powerful tool.
Mm-hmm.
Protective factor, isn't it, denial? Really. Yeah. And even denial if you perpetrate.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's incredibly interesting to see how we can, unfortunately, our denial can actually protect offenders.
Yeah.
A lot.
Mm.
Every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m., tune in to Department Uno to hear the latest and greatest from the CJSF playlist, featuring all new music from local, Canadian, and international artists. Fresh releases from the music department every week on Department Uno, only on CJSF 90.1 FM.
My name is Jamie Hill. I'm the Design and Communications Manager at Embark Sustainability. I think my favorite thing about Embark is that you do not have to be the climate know-it-all. You don't have to know everything about the issues that are going on. You really just need the passion to get started. So depending on what you're interested in, you might have a unique skill or interest that you don't think is applicable to climate at all, and it turns out you are the people that we need to be part of the community. So I'd really encourage anybody who has even an inkling of interest in climate or food justice to get on board. Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.
And welcome back to Intravenous here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby Campus and Community Radio from Simon Fraser University. And we just heard the part one to my discussion with Leonie, the CEO of the charity Justice Is Now in England, talking about some of the challenges in the criminal justice system for rape and serious sexual offences, and what her charity is committed to doing, and looking a bit on how legal professionals are kind of also in the centre of this problem, looking at the educational pieces that they offer and things like that. So, yes, I want to thank Leonie once more for taking the time to have a chat with me. I will be airing part two of that discussion next Wednesday on Intravenous, so be sure to tune back in then. And I would like to remind you all to stay tuned for Democracy Now!, which is coming up in about the next 6 minutes at 11 a.m. here on CJSF 90.1 FM. And as I am finishing up here on Intravenous, I am going to leave you with two songs. We're going to start off with a song by Michaela May called You Made Me Hate My Favorite Songs, and then we're going to move on to Tail Whip by Men I Trust. And so I hope you all have a great rest of your day and rest of your week, and I'll see you next Wednesday here on Intravenous. Thank you.
phone. Then I undid it, cause I wonder how you're doing. And still think you're someone I miss, but that's not true. I'm doing just fine without you. It's not like I'm lacking much. I gave way more than I got, and I just begged to be in your thoughts, but now I know.
Please will be